Hi everyone, my name is Mike DeBliss. I am presenting today on the topic of IRS information gathering. The title of this program is From Summonses to International Evidence Gathering Techniques, How the IRS Gathers Evidence in the 21st Century. A little bit about me. I'm a trial lawyer. I had my start as when I got out of law school as a public defender in the New Jersey Office of the Public Defender. You might find it odd that I'm lecturing on tax today. Well, I can only tell you that the reason why I kind of took a slight detour into the tax arena is because in my last year of law school, I had the unique opportunity of participating in a white-collar criminal defense case. I was externing for a criminal defense firm that was defending a client who had been charged with money laundering. And I was assigned the task of researching and writing many of the briefs that had to be submitted. And I've noticed along the way that there were a myriad of tax charges that accompanied the money laundering charge. And they were the basis of a number of motions that we were arguing. So I became immersed in the Internal Revenue Code and in these specific criminal statutes that penalized tax evasion and filing a false tax return, et cetera, et cetera. So I realized that I had an interest in the area of tax law, and I put it on hold or put it on the shelf for a little while. And then I came back to it after being out of law school and working for nearly 6 years. I returned to school to earn my master's in tax law. Some say that I was crazy because I was working nearly 80 hours a week as a public defender, trying case after case after case, and there wasn't really a lot of free time to begin with, but I made a point of allocating my time and making sure that I set aside enough time to prepare for the upcoming classes or the upcoming week's lectures. And I got through. It took me about 3 years, but I earned my master's in tax law. And I then went into private practice. And I learned quite fast that criminal tax defense wasn't the only area of tax law that I enjoyed. I was very interested in international tax compliance, specifically helping U.S. Expats who were living abroad or even in the U.S. come into compliance with their international U.S. tax obligations. So I began assisting expats in getting into compliance with those obligations through streamlined procedures and through the Offshore Voluntary Disclosure Program. So I became a vital resource, I'd like to think, for those who needed consultation and who needed advice on what the best means of coming into compliance with their tax obligations was. And in some cases, it was nothing more than a reasonable cause letter. In other cases, it required a streamlined submission. And in those cases where the behavior tended to be closer on the risk scale to willfulness, the Offshore Voluntary Disclosure Program was suitable. So that's a little bit about me. We're going to talk about IRS summons power to start. That's found in the Internal Revenue Code, Section 7602A. It empowers the IRS to examine books and records, take testimony under oath, and issue summonses to taxpayers or any other person the IRS may deem proper. Rules for issuing summonses. Summonses can be issued by IRS examination personnel, IRS collection personnel, and IRS CI personnel. CI stands for criminal investigation. That's a unit of the IRS. How does the IRS serve the summons on the taxpayer or other target? They can hand deliver it to a witness. They can leave a copy at the person's last and usual place of abode Or if it is a so-called third-party record keeper summons, they can deliver it by certified or registered mail. So those are the three ways in which the IRS will serve a summons. A summons might ask for any one of a number of things. It might include testimony. It might request documents. What kind of notice are taxpayers entitled to when the IRS issues a summons to a third party? Now, this is a situation in which the IRS identifies a third party as possessing information that it would like to obtain, perhaps to build a case against the client, or perhaps representations made by the taxpayer. So what kind of notice is a taxpayer entitled to when the IRS issues a summons to a third party? Well, like many answers that lawyers give, it depends. It depends on A, who issues the summons. Is it CI that issues it or examinations? And second, who is the person receiving the summons? Is it, for example, a third-party record keeper? If the taxpayer is entitled to notice, then he has the right to intervene in the summons enforcement case or bring a proceeding to quash the summons. That's a technical term used to destroy or vitiate the summons. It's called quashing, bringing a proceeding to quash the summons. Generally, the IRS must notify taxpayers being examined of the issuance of summonses to third parties. So that's a general bright line rule found in IRC 7609. Now, there are some exceptions to the requirement that the IRS must notify taxpayers being examined of the issuance of summonses to third parties. A taxpayer is not entitled to notice of a summons on a third party under the following if one or two of the following conditions exist. First, the summons is issued by a criminal investigator of the IRS in connection with the investigation of an offense that is related to the enforcement of the Internal Revenue laws. Or second, a court determines that there is reasonable cause, just reasonable cause, that's a very low threshold, reasonable cause to believe the giving of notice may lead to attempts to conceal, destroy, or alter records relevant to the examination. So I would suspect that number two probably makes sense, in the sense that if a court forced the IRS to give a taxpayer notice of a summons that was issued to a third party, under the circumstances that the IRS believed that giving the notice to the taxpayer might lead the taxpayer to engage in some type of tax hanky-panky, of course, the courts lean on the side of the IRS and have found in case after case that the IRS doesn't have an obligation to inform the taxpayer of the notice of summons on the third party. But number one might not be so obvious, so it's worth repeating. If a summons is issued by a criminal investigator of the IRS in connection with the investigation of an offense that is related to the enforcement of the Internal Revenue Code, then the IRS has no obligation to notify the taxpayer that it has issued a summons on a third party. A summons enforcement proceedings. Now, it's important to recognize that a summons is not self-enforcing. Instead, it must be enforced by an action in federal court. So this only really is relevant if the target of the summons, the taxpayer, let's call him or her the taxpayer, chooses not to comply with the summons. In the event that the target taxpayer refuses to comply with the summons, it's not automatically self-enforcing. The IRS basically has to go to court and get the judge to compel the taxpayer to turn over what is being demanded. So what happens if the taxpayer refuses to comply with the summons? The government has to go to court to enforce it. A summons enforcement action begins with the government filing a petition seeking an order to show cause. That's a very low threshold. And that showing, that filing of the petition is accompanied by an affidavit of the issuing IRS agent. The affidavit provides the prima facie case to demonstrate compliance with the requirements for enforcement. So the IRS doesn't get a pass. It has to demonstrate that it has issued the summons in compliance with the requirements for summons enforcement. We'll get to that in a second. So I have a little question here, just to make sure that you're following. Is a summons self-enforcing? A is yes, and B is no. If you recall, as we've already discussed, a summons is not self-enforcing. If a taxpayer refuses to comply with it, the government must go into court to enforce it. Second, what must the affidavit consist of? Under the case of Powell, the government must make a prima facie showing of the following. First, that the summons was issued for a legitimate purpose. Second, that the material sought is relevant to that purpose. Third, that the information sought is not already within the possession of the IRS. And fourth, that administrative steps required by the Internal Revenue Code have been followed. These requirements are worth memorizing in the event that you have a client who comes to you and who wants and who does not want to turn over the documents or the information that the IRS is demanding via the summons. You want to check that these four conditions have been satisfied before you do another thing. First, you want to make sure that the summons was issued for a legitimate purpose. Second, that the material being sought by the IRS is relevant to that purpose. Third, that the information sought is not already within the possession of the IRS. And fourth, that the administrative steps required by the Internal Revenue Code have been followed. And again, this is what all affidavits must consist of. Once the government makes out its prima facie case, the burden of going forward shifts to the taxpayer. So the way this dance starts is that the taxpayer refuses to comply with the summons, and then the government goes to court to get the judge to enforce the summons. And then the government, when it goes to court, must make out a prima facie case. Assuming that it does, the burden shifts to the taxpayer. The taxpayer has the right to challenge the summons on any appropriate ground, including the following. The first ground is that the four factors set out in Powell have not been satisfied. So that's why I said it's worth committing to memory these four requirements laid out in the case of Powell. If one or more of those requirements have not been satisfied, then that alone would give the taxpayer the right to challenge the summons because it would be considered an appropriate ground for doing so. But if the four factors set out in Powell have been satisfied, there still are three other ways that the taxpayer can challenge the summons. These three other grounds consist of the following: that the summons or the subpoena is unreasonable as to place or time, that proper service is lacking, and that the summons was issued in bad faith. That last requirement, that the summons was issued in bad faith, comes out of the case of U.S. versus Clark. So if we consolidate everything into a neat package that you can refer to whenever a client comes to you wanting to quash a summons, in generally speaking, the appropriate grounds for a taxpayer to have the right to challenge a summons consists of the following: that one or more of the four POW factors have not been satisfied. Second, that the summons or subpoena is unreasonable as to time or place. Third, that proper service is lacking. And fourth, that the summons was issued in bad faith. In an enforcement proceeding, the court's role is not to second guess the judgment of the IRS, but instead to determine whether the particular summons was a legitimate exercise of the IRS's investigative authority. That is a standard in which the court will review this. It will once again seek to determine whether the summons was a legitimate exercise of the IRS's investigative authority. Let's talk a little bit about the third-party record keeper summons. Normally, taxpayers are not entitled to notice if a summons is issued, or sorry, is served on a third party during a criminal investigation. You might remember that note at the top of the presentation. There is a general rule that states that when there is a criminal investigation and the IRS is attempting to obtain information from a third party via a summons, the IRS does not have the obligation to notify the taxpayer that it has served a summons on that third party. And that is one of the rules to commit to memory. However, there is an exception, and the exception is called the third party record keeper exception. Who are third party record keepers? Well, they include banks, consumer reports or agencies, credit card companies, brokers, attorneys, and accountants. So it's worth committing these record keepers to memory. Once again, banks, consumer reports or agencies, credit card companies, brokers, attorneys, and accountants. The question that I have here is, which of the following is not a third-party record keeper? We have A, bank, B, broker, C, attorney, D, taxpayer's employer. If you selected D, then you're right on the money. A bank, a broker, and an attorney are all considered a third-party record keeper. If a summons is issued to a third-party record keeper, the taxpayer may first bring a proceeding to quash the summons, or second, intervene in a proceeding brought by the IRS to enforce the summons. John Doe summonses. What is a John Doe summons? It's a summons issued to a third party, like a bank, seeking information regarding taxpayers whose identities are unknown to the IRS. We're going to get into a more robust discussion about John Doe summonses in the area of FATCA, or Foreign Account Tax Compliance Act, later on in this presentation. But getting back to John Doe summonses, their purpose is to find out who the taxpayers are so that an investigation can be undertaken. There are times, and so to give you some background information, there are times when the IRS knows or strongly suspects that tax shenanigans or hanky-panky is going on, but doesn't know who's behind it. The government must obtain judicial approval from a magistrate judge for a John Doe summons. Prior judicial approval is not a huge safeguard for the taxpayer because these proceedings are ex parte. And so a question, the next logical question that comes up is, why are these proceedings ex parte? First, the IRS doesn't know who the taxpayers are, so it can't invite them to court. That's probably the most obvious reason. But second, the IRS doesn't want to have to deal with an adversary. So that is a potential second reason that they are ex parte. The government must convince a court of the following. First, that the investigation relates to a particular person. Second, that there is reasonable cause to believe that the person may not have complied with the tax laws. And third, that the information sought is not readily available from other sources. I would I would tell you that the third requirement tends to be the one that gets challenged the most for these John Doe summonses, that the information sought is not readily available, or I should invert it and say that the information sought is readily available from other sources, thus negating that third requirement. So once again, before the court will unanimously give approval for a John Doe summons, it must be satisfied that the investigation relates to a particular person, that there is reasonable cause to believe that the person identified may not have complied with the tax laws or obeyed the tax laws. And third, that the information sought is not readily available from other sources. Overwhelmingly, the magistrate approves the government's application. Dual purpose summonses. The question here is, can the IRS gather information on a known person as well as an unknown person through a summons and without obtaining judicial approval from a magistrate judge, as would otherwise be the case for a John Doe summons? So what we have here is a situation in which there is a hybrid where the IRS where the IRS has already identified one potential target. We'll call that person the known person, but there's also an unknown person. And so the IRS in this particular case is looking to obtain information from both the known person as well as the unknown person. And they want to do so through a summons and without obtaining judicial approval from the magistrate, as would otherwise be required for a John Doe summons of an unknown party. And so the rule here is that a summons may be issued for a dual purpose. That is, it may be used in order to obtain information relating to an identified taxpayer as well as an unidentified taxpayer. So that is a victory for the IRS because, as we know from earlier, when it comes to an unknown person and a John Doe summons, the IRS has to satisfy the magistrate judge of those requirements in an ex parte proceeding. However, when it comes to a known person and obtaining information from a known person through a summons, there is not the government doesn't have to jump through the hoops that it otherwise would if it was trying to obtain information via a John Doe summons from an unknown person. So I realize that that's a mouthful, but if you want to memorize the rule is that a summons may be issued for a dual purpose. It may be used in order to obtain information relating to both an identified taxpayer as well as an unidentified taxpayer. And that comes from Tiffany Fine Arts case. So let's see an example of a case where the government went too far. That comes out of a circuit court case called U.S. versus Gertner. In that case, the government argued mixed circumstances. We don't need ex parte approval. The court held that the summons was not enforceable. The IRS's use of the regular summons was not in good faith. Let's talk a little bit about grand jury subpoenas. Grand jury subpoenas are an alternative to the traditional administrative route of issuing a summons. The grand jury subpoena is more powerful than the IRS summons. How does a grand jury subpoena compare with the IRS administrative summons? First, a grand jury subpoena is self-enforcing. Failure to comply with a grand jury subpoena automatically constitutes contempt. So remember that when it comes to a summons, it's not self-enforcing or self-executing. The IRS has to go to court and convince the judge that it satisfied the requirements. And then and only then, if the judge agrees and finds that it has followed all the requirements, then the judge will enforce the summons against that party. But again, the IRS has to take that added step of going to court and making out a prima facie case. The difference with a grand jury subpoena is that it's self-enforcing. So failing to comply with it automatically constitutes contempt. Second, the witness must appear before the grand jury alone and cannot have his attorney present. Third, an IRS administrative summons to a third party requires notice to the taxpayer. The grand jury subpoena, by contrast, has no notice requirements. So the IRS doesn't have to notify the taxpayer in a situation where it's obtaining a grand jury subpoena. And thus, the IRS doesn't have to worry about information leaking out to the taxpayer, and then the taxpayer perhaps withholding information or playing tax hanky-panky with the IRS. Search warrants. The IRS has increasingly used a search warrant as an investigative tool. Search warrants involve the Fourth Amendment. Traditional requirements for the issuance of a search warrant must be met. So there must be probable cause to believe that a crime has been committed. Second, probable cause to believe that the taxpayer committed the crime. Third, probable cause to believe that the premises to be searched provides information pertaining to the crime. So here we have a question. What is not one of the requirements for obtaining a search warrant? And your choices are A, probable cause to believe that a crime has been committed. B, reasonable suspicion that books or records will be found in the location to be searched. If you selected B, you are right on the money. In order for a search warrant to be executed, the IRS or the government does not have to make a showing that there's reasonable suspicion that books or records will be found in the location to be searched. Again, the requirements for a search warrant are that A, probable cause to believe that a crime has been committed, B, probable cause to believe that the taxpayer committed the crime, and C, probable cause to believe that the premises to be searched provides information pertaining to the crime. Even if an IRS special agent believes that he or she can establish probable cause to seek a search warrant, he must still consult with an attorney from IRS's chief counsel office who must review and approve all Title 26 search warrants. After obtaining approval, the special agent may ask an assistant U.S. attorney from DOJ Tax to apply for the search warrant. So that's the cadence or the dance that goes on. Even if the IRS special agent believes that he has probable cause to seek a search warrant, he cannot arbitrarily obtain a search warrant. He must still consult with an attorney from IRS's chief counsel office, and the attorney from IRS's chief counsel office must review and approve all search warrant affidavits. After obtaining approval, the special agent may ask an assistant U.S. attorney from DOJ Tax to apply for the search warrant. In cases where the target is a doctor, a lawyer, an accountant, or a public official, search warrants require the approval of the assistant U.S. attorney in charge of the tax division. So generally speaking, when the target is a professional, and this is not a complete list, it's just a partial list, but doctor, lawyer, accountant, or public official falls within that classification of professionals. When the target is one of those individuals, the search warrant must be approved by the assistant U.S. attorney in charge of the tax division. And that comes out of the case of U.S. versus Liefkowitz. Sting operations. These are used in cases where the government is going after organized crime. So let's talk a little bit about international evidence gathering. I'm just going to grab a sip of water and I'll be right back. The explosive growth of international business has been accompanied by an explosive growth in tax fraud across international borders. More and more businesses are becoming globalized. Tax fraud is becoming more and more international. There are a lot of complex tax evasion schemes that have cross-border aspects. Some U.S. citizens park money abroad as a way of avoiding U.S. taxes. Sometimes the foreign jurisdiction is just as interested in having U.S. cooperation to prevent evasion of their tax laws as the U.S. is interested in having the foreign country's cooperation to prevent evasion of their tax laws. I'll back up just to say that just because a U.S. Person has money in a foreign bank account doesn't mean that they're evading taxes, U.S. taxes. There are a myriad of legitimate reasons why a U.S. person might maintain accounts with a foreign bank. The most glaring one is if they are doing business abroad or if they work abroad. Another reason why a U.S. person might have a foreign bank account is if they inherited it from a loved one back in the old country. So I'm not automatically labeling anybody who has money stored abroad as a tax evader. Far from it. As a matter of fact, the statistics show that a very small percentage of individuals actually store money abroad as a way of evading taxes. About 10 years ago, that statistic might have been very different. But today, in the age of FATCA, and after years and years of the Offshore Voluntary Disclosure Program, most tax cheats have come forward through voluntary compliance or voluntary disclosure programs to disclose their assets abroad, and have come under an amnesty program known as the Offshore Voluntary Disclosure Program or the Streamlined Disclosure Program, which we'll talk about more as we get on in the presentation. But some countries are active enablers of international tax evasion. These countries have staked a significant part of their economic future on benefiting from international tax evasion. The IRS wants foreign financial institutions to disclose the name of their U.S. account holders. Sometimes foreign countries are happy to cooperate, other times they aren't. And it's usually the latter, that they aren't. So here are the primary methods that the IRS uses for obtaining foreign evidence. There is the traditional methods, which we've already talked about, summonses and subpoenas. But then there are mutual legal assistance treaties. And third, there are tax information exchange agreements and income tax treaties. Then there are letters rogatory. And finally, there is FATCA, which is short or the mnemonic for Foreign Account Tax Compliance Act. We're going to get into specifics about that later in the presentation. The first four, right off the bat, have major shortcomings. So let's discuss each one by itself. The traditional method is usually the government's first resort. If a foreign financial institution has a branch in the U.S., the IRS may serve a summons or subpoena on the U.S. branch. If the U.S. branch fails to respond to the summons or subpoena, then they're subject to contempt sanctions. What are some of the arguments that you might anticipate a foreign bank to make in response to a summons or subpoena? As shocking as this might sound, some foreign banks think that the amount they have to pay the U.S. government for violating its laws through contempt sanctions is less than the economic benefit derived from facilitating tax evasion. In other words, they view it as a cost of doing business. And you might want to think about this from the foreign bank's perspective. International banking laws, like those in Switzerland, were once extremely protective of client anonymity. Anyone who revealed details of client accounts could be charged with breaking Swiss bank secrecy laws. And if they did, they could be prosecuted and, if convicted, sent to prison. It was the equivalent of treason. The chief argument raised by Swiss banks was that the US government was attempting to force them to break Swiss law by disclosing US account holder information. Until FATCA went into effect, this put Swiss banks and bank personnel between a rock and a hard place. What were they supposed to do? On the one hand, the US government demanded that they produce the names and account holder information of their US account holders. On the other hand, doing so was against Swiss law. And so if they were to abide by what the US government demanded, then by doing so, they were breaking Swiss law and almost definitely getting themselves prosecuted under Swiss law. So by abiding by another country's law, they were breaking their own country's law. In resolving these conflicts, the U.S. District Court had to balance the equities in deciding whether or not to enforce the summons or subpoena. So as you can tell, there were a number of shortcomings and drawbacks, because many banks simply refused to obey a summons issued by the IRS on the grounds that A, they were protecting their account holders, and B, that by following or by complying with an IRS summons, they were breaking their own country's laws. The second form of international evidence gathering consists of mutual legal assistance treaties. What are they? Well, these are special treaties specifically designed for tax enforcement, in which countries bilaterally pledge to assist each other in information gathering to deal with tax avoidance and evasion. Then we have tax information exchange agreements. These are known as TIEAs, and income tax treaties. What is a TIEA? It's an agreement which specifically provides for mutual assistance in criminal and civil tax investigations. The assistance includes obtaining foreign-based documents, including bank records and testimony in admissible form. They are creatures of the Internal Revenue Code. Income tax treaties include information exchange and administrative cooperation provisions. So MLATs, tax information exchange agreements, and standard tax treaties contain provisions for international cooperation. The caveat is that they exist only if the country is interested in signing such an agreement with the US. Now we'll talk about letters rogatory. This is a technique in which the US federal courts transmit, through the US State Department and through the foreign ministry of the foreign country, a request to a foreign court asking it to provide assistance with respect to an ongoing matter in the US court. If the foreign court honors the request, it does so based on comity, C-O-M-I-T-Y, not comedy, rather than any treaty obligation. The foreign court does it. Basically, the translation here is that the foreign court does it if it feels like it. In the rare case that it feels like it, it can take forever. And now we get into the Foreign Account Tax Compliance Act. Recognizing that there was a substantial amount of money stored overseas that has gone unreported and that would continue to go unreported if left up to the taxpayer to voluntarily disclose, Congress passed the Foreign Account Tax Compliance Act. The Foreign Account Tax Compliance Act requires foreign financial institutions to report specific information regarding their U.S. account holders to the IRS. It was passed in 2010 to clamp down on the U.S. of foreign bank accounts by U.S. taxpayers to hide money that was otherwise subject to taxation in the U.S. FATCA is the U.S. government's newest enforcement tool in the fight against international tax evasion. And by new, I really mean new in comparison to the other methods that exist. It's not all that new because it's been around since 2010, which makes it 13 years old. So we're going to talk about the FATCA hurricane, as I like to call it. I'm just going to take a quick sip of water and I'll be right back. So let's clear up a major misconception. And I really want to, I can't emphasize this enough. It is not illegal for a U.S. taxpayer to have an overseas bank account. Once again, there are a myriad of legitimate reasons why a U.S. person or a U.S. taxpayer would want to have and maintain an overseas bank account. Overseas financial accounts are maintained for a variety of legitimate reasons. The history of this is that if the average American that owns a foreign bank account isn't a tax cheat, what are his reasons for having a foreign account? Well, I've named a few already, but I will make this list even more exhaustive. Reason number one, in the not too distant past, wealthy Americans and wannabe wealthy Americans found it convenient or fashionable to put much of their wealth in offshore financial institutions. Although it was not the only player in this game, Switzerland attracted much of the American wealth, which was banked offshore. There are many countries in the Caribbean, as well as Israel, who were more than willing to provide this service, but Switzerland was the biggest name in the industry. Second reason, convenience and access. In this global marketplace, many U.S. citizens have relocated abroad. Thus, maintaining an account with a local bank in order to conduct day-to-day affairs is an absolute necessity. And here's, you know, just basic run-of-the-mill things such as paying rent, paying a phone, insurance, Wi-Fi, electric bills, buying groceries, going out for meals, you know, you name it. Reason number three, the U.S. person may have inherited a foreign bank account from a relative back in the old country. So here's the problem. The U.S. taxes its citizens on their worldwide income, regardless of where it is earned. So you could be living in the United States, but operating a business or a company, half a world away in, say, Australia or Sri Lanka. Even though you're located in the United States and you're a U.S. citizen, you still must report the profits of that foreign business on your U.S. tax return. So if you work for a Belgian company in Costa Rica, you must report the earnings on your U.S. tax return. Very simply, U.S. taxpayers report all of their income, even income earned outside of the United States. Prior to 2010, many individuals with overseas accounts failed to mention this fact when they filed their 1040s. They also failed to file what's called a foreign bank account report to disclose the existence of their foreign account. So let me back up for a second. On a 1040, there's two very specific questions. It asks the taxpayer if they have an interest in or signature authority over a foreign bank account. And if you answer that question yes, there's a follow-up question which refers you to the foreign bank account report and basically puts you on notice that you might have an obligation to file an FBAR. So prior to 2010, many individuals with overseas accounts would overlook this question or even check the box off no when they had a foreign bank account. What is the FBAR? The FBAR is a creature of the Bank Secrecy Act. It's been in existence since time immemorial, but only really began to get a lot of attention in the aftermath of 2000 of the terrorist attacks of 9/11. The IRS and the government overall began to realize that the FBAR was a tool that they could use to help stamp out terrorism by stopping money flowing to the source. So the information that can be obtained from an FBAR was information that the government deemed useful in following the trail of money that was going from legitimate sources to illegitimate sources and terrorist organizations. So the government began to enforce the FBAR with abandon in the aftermath of 2001. They also recognized the fact that failures to comply with the FBAR led to penalties that were on par with the civil fraud penalty. So it was a win-win situation for the government. They saw it as an opportunity to obtain information that would lead them to terrorist organizations so that they can shut them down by stopping the flow of money to those organizations. And secondly, they saw it as a way of the government obtaining, badly needed money in its coffers. So it was a way of raising money for the government at the same time, because the failure to file FBAR penalties were so exorbitant because they were tied to the high maximum balance of the account that wasn't disclosed, that they would bring in tons and tons of money. So the FBAR is a tool used by the U.S. government to identify persons who may be using foreign financial accounts to break U.S. law. Information contained in FBARs can be used to identify or trace funds used for illegal purposes or to identify unreported income maintained or generated abroad. It, once again, is a creature of the Bank Secrecy Act and not the Internal Revenue Code. It has been on the books for a long time. The Bank Secrecy Act gives the Department of Treasury the authority to collect information from U.S. persons who have financial interest in or signature authority over financial accounts maintained at foreign financial institutions. So it's not just U.S. persons who have financial interest in the account. They can have merely signature authority over the financial accounts, and they would still have an FBAR filing obligation. Who must file an FBAR? A U.S. person must file an FBAR if that person has a financial interest in or signature authority over any financial account outside of the U.S. and the aggregate maximum value of the account exceeds $10,000 at any time during the calendar year. Again, the government did not begin enforcing FBARs with the gusto that it does today until after 9/11. Side note here, when it's very important to pay attention to every word in this rule, because every one is a term of art. And if you take the standard Webster definition and apply it to some of these terms, you will badly interpret the rule and impart wrong advice to your client. So what I want to make a point of saying is that aggregate maximum value has a very specific meaning. What that means is that the government will look at all of the taxpayers' foreign bank accounts for a given tax year. And to the extent that the maximum balance of each one of the accounts falls below $10,000, That doesn't mean that the government stops there and agrees with the taxpayer that they have no FBAR reporting obligation. Instead, the government aggregates the maximum value of each of those accounts. So let's say, for example, that John is a U.S. person who has a financial interest in three foreign bank accounts with a foreign bank. And let's say that each one of those foreign bank accounts had a high watermark balance of $9,000 at a specific point in time in that tax year. What would happen is that the government would look at those, at the maximum account value of each of those accounts, and find that it was $9,000. And then it would add or multiply that 9,000 times three, because John had three foreign accounts and the high watermark balance of each of those accounts was $9,000. And as you can tell, the aggregate maximum balance when you combine all three accounts comes to $27,000 US. That's $17,000 more than the maximum value that triggers the FBAR reporting obligation. So what that tells us is that even though that John must file an FBAR, even though none of the accounts alone exceeded the threshold, the fact that all three accounts, that the maximum balance, aggregate maximum balance of all three accounts exceeded $27,000, means that John had an FBAR filing obligation. The second step would be to ask what bank accounts must be listed on the FBAR in order for John to have filed a proper FBAR for that year. John would have to report all three of the accounts. So you can see the devil is in the details. That three-term phrase, aggregate maximum value, has an incredible amount of meaning. And if you were to interpret it as aggregate maximum value as only looking at each account, you would not have filed an FBAR for John under those facts. But once you know now that aggregate maximum value takes into consideration all the taxpayers' foreign bank accounts, you know that if you have a similar situation like John with one of your clients, that you would still have to file the FBAR. What are some of the reasons why the average American living abroad did not report their foreign bank accounts to the IRS? Again, some of the reasons for this are not directly illegal. Some taxpayers very simply didn't know what an FBAR was, let alone that it applied to them. These folks didn't know that they had an obligation to report their foreign income on a U.S. return. For example, many thought that they had satisfied their tax obligations by virtue of having reported their foreign source income on a foreign tax return and paying taxes to the foreign government. So let's take, for example, John again. Let's say that he had a company in Costa Rica. And let's say that John had an accountant in Costa Rica that had reported his earnings to the Costa Rican government for the tax year in question. John might have felt that, you know, he satisfied his tax obligations for that year by having filed a foreign tax return. However, the fact even if his U.S. tax liability would be negligible for that tax year, he still had an obligation to disclose his foreign accounts on his U.S. tax return on the 1040 and by filing an FBAR. Another reason why the average American living abroad may not have reported their foreign bank account is that they knew exactly what their U.S. tax obligations were, but thought that it was unlikely that the IRS would ever know the difference. Again, under the theory that their tax liability to the U.S. government was so minimal that it might have been dollars at the end of the day, that there was no need to, you know, there was no need to ring the bell and to even to complicate their tax filing anymore, because the corresponding tax liability was going to be negligible. I say this not because I agree with this, but just to put you in the shoes of those back then who had foreign bank accounts and weren't reporting them, so that you understand a little bit more about the reasons for why they didn't disclose. So what is it about this pestilent law that engenders such strong emotions? From the perspective of foreign banks, it turns foreign banks and foreign and financial institutions into enforcement arms of the IRS. This allows the IRS to make sure they are collecting every possible dollar from U.S. taxpayers who have offshore assets. Although they seemingly have two options, disclose information on clients who are U.S. persons or pay a whopping 30% of all payments they receive from America to the IRS, that's basically what the penalty is, most foreign financial institutions would argue that they have only one real choice if they want to be around long enough to report next year's quarterlies, and that is to succumb to Uncle Sam's heavy-handed demands and turn over U.S. account holder information. From the perspective of U.S. taxpayers with unreported foreign accounts, they argue that it treats us it treats every taxpayer with a foreign bank account as though they are Al Capone. How so? Well, the IRS punishes such taxpayers with penalties that are so severe that it could leave them with nothing more than the shirt on their backs. For example, willful FBAR penalties are the greater of $100,000 or 50% of the closing balance in the account as of the last day of filing the FBAR. Considering the fact that FBAR penalties are assessed per account and not per year, this could drive a taxpayer's FBAR penalties right into the stratosphere. And I can attest to that, because oftentimes when clients come to me and or came to me back in the day of the OVDP, I would have to do a risk assessment for them and compare what their FBAR penalties would be if they did not go into the offshore voluntary disclosure program versus what their penalties would be if I shepherded them through the offshore voluntary disclosure program. The OVDP, for short, was the amnesty program that taxpayers whose failure to disclose their foreign bank accounts veered more towards the willful end of the spectrum than the non-willful. The offshore voluntary disclosure program was specifically designed for them so that they could get into compliance with their U.S. tax obligations without the risk of an audit that would lead to exorbitant FBAR penalties and without a possible referral to the criminal investigation arm of the IRS, which could have led to an indictment. So again, these are whopping and staggering penalties, and I would oftentimes get asked to do a comparison of what the FBAR penalties would be, following an examination or an audit, versus what the penalties would be for the taxpayer to come clean and voluntarily disclose their accounts under the offshore voluntary disclosure program. Most of the time, all the time, I should say, the penalty, as severe as it was in the offshore voluntary disclosure program, was still significantly less than what the willful FBAR penalty would be. And that's because, as you can see here, it says that willful FBAR penalties are the greater of $100,000 or 50% of the closing balance in the account as of the last day of filing the FBAR. So again, if for the willful FBAR, for the willful taxpayer, it oftentimes made sense for them to go via the OVDP route. But for the non-willful FBAR taxpayer, the penalties were substantially less, and so it might have made sense to make what's called a quiet disclosure by merely submitting delinquent 1040s with a reasonable cause explanation, so long as it was a mere oversight, the failure to file the FBAR for the years in question. Critics weigh in. Those that denounced the law criticized its complexity, its expansive reach, and the high cost of compliance. The argument went something like this. With FATCA, the U.S. government has found a very effective way to bully foreign governments and financial institutions into giving its previously unobtainable information on U.S. taxpayers. Those that like it, and there are a few, but they're in the minority, they argue that it would blow the lid off of the old way of exchanging tax information between countries on request, which they viewed as too lenient on tax cheats. FATCA, they predict, will revolutionize the exchange of information by making it automatic, thereby removing any safe harbors for those who have, shall we say, less than pure motives. The carrot and the stick. FATCA gets its teeth from two provisions. I already foreshadowed one of them. Non-compliant foreign financial banks face a mandatory 30% withholding on payments from U.S.-based financial institutions, and that really does put a dent in their earnings. Second, FATCA beefed up the ability of the Department of Justice to prosecute foreign banks criminally who were assisting U.S. taxpayers with tax evasion. I'll take you back to the first banks were targeted under FATCA. They lo and behold came from Switzerland. And so Switzerland's financial industry was landfall for Hurricane FATCA, as I call it, and I would coin it a Category 5 plus storm. Under FATCA, Swiss banking powerhouse UBS was forced to turn over the names and information of 4,000 U.S. taxpayers. In order to settle a corporate criminal action for failure to comply, UBS paid a $780 million fine. $780 million. I mean, it's unfathomable. And again, this was back early on. And I think this might have been like in 2010 or 11. Many Swiss institutions got the point and came into compliance. To prove its power to bankers who didn't comply after UBS, the Department of Justice's next target was Switzerland's oldest bank. And the oldest bank was Wegelin and Company. That shot proved to be fatal. Wegelin paid $74 million in fines, restitution, and forfeitures, and ceased to do business to avoid criminal activity or to avoid criminal liability. The end of Swiss bank secrecy as the world once knew it. In August of 2013, Switzerland raised the white flag. To avoid further prosecutions, it signed what's called a non-prosecution agreement with the U.S. government, or NPA for short, for banks that have facilitated American tax evasion. In theory, these agreements guarantee banks immunity from prosecution, but the devil is in the details. In December of that same year, 100 Swiss banks joined in the proposed amnesty deal with the DOJ. There is still ongoing debate over the fairness of the Justice Department's NPA proposal. However, it appears that Switzerland and many other countries got the message clearly. The U.S. will no longer tolerate the non-disclosure of U.S. taxpayer information. It appears that the Department of Justice may have attempted to slide a couple of extra provisions into the non-prosecution agreement. And this is a laundry list. And I realize it's quite long, but this is what is included in the NPAs that the government has inked. First, cooperate fully with the Department of Justice, the IRS, and any other domestic or foreign law enforcement agency designated by the Department of Justice regarding all matters related to the NPA. Second, assist the Department of Justice or any designated domestic or foreign law enforcement agency in any investigation, prosecution, or civil proceeding arising from or related to the NPA. Third, provide testimony as needed to enable the U.S. to use the information and evidence provided by the bank under the NPA. Next, provide the Department of Justice all requested information, documents, records, or other tangible evidence not protected by legal privilege regarding the covered conduct. Next, to retain all records relating to its U.S. cross-border business for a period of 10 years from the NPA's termination date. Finally, the agreement describes the circumstances under which the Department of Justice may determine that a bank has violated the NPA and may be prosecuted. So just by signing it alone doesn't exempt the bank from subsequent prosecution. 73 Swiss banks responded in a joint letter saying that they would not sign the NPA as proposed. The bank's objections were fairly straightforward and simple. Since when does a U.S. Department of Justice have the authority to make a foreign bank cooperate in investigations by other foreign governments? Next, the fact that the NPA contained language basically saying that the Department of Justice had the right to change its mind and prosecute anyway. So is that really a non-prosecution agreement, or is it a license for a fishing expedition that could lead to prosecution anyway? So for example, with the wealth of information that NPA required the banks to turn over, would the Department of Justice then take that information that it only obtained through the NPA and turn around and use it against the bank to prosecute it while this NPA was intact? I mean, if you think about it, it is definitely a license for a fishing expedition in the sense that the government doesn't have to honor the agreement and can take the very information that it never would have obtained but for the NPA and use that as a way to process and use that as a weapon to file a prosecution against the bank. So is the NPA, how protective is the NPA if the Department of Justice can circumvent it and take the very information that it would have never gotten, but for the NPA to later prosecute the bank? As more countries are pushed to the brink to share tax information, the focus will now shift to America's willingness to reciprocate. Who can forget the expression, "What's good for the goose is good for the gander"? Is it hypocrisy? At present, the U.S. does not provide the same detailed information about foreign account holders who bank with U.S. banks to foreign governments that it requires foreign banks to provide to them. So, for example, if a citizen of, say, let's pick a country, could be any country, let's say South America. Let's say a citizen of South America maintains banks in the United States. What this is saying is that the U.S. government does not disclose the same volume and type and of information to the South American government as it requires the South American government to provide to it for its citizens and U.S. persons. So you see that there is a disparity and there's hypocrisy because the U.S. government isn't turning over the same amount of information to the foreign taxing authority that it requires the foreign government or taxing authority to turn over to it for its citizens and residents. So I do smell hypocrisy here. I'd like to talk a little bit about the mechanics of how information gets exchanged via FATCA. I'm just going to take a quick sip of water. So this gets very technical. I am going to try to walk you through this step by step, because a lot of these model agreements are no longer in effect. But I do think in a sense, it's helpful to understand where we've come. It's helpful to understand where we are now by knowing where we've come from. So there are primarily two forms of exchange. One is called the Model 1 Intergovernmental Agreement, and the second is Model 2 Intergovernmental Agreement. I refer to them as IGA. Under a Model 2 agreement, that'll be the one that we start out with first. Model, I'm sorry, under we're going to start with Model 2 IGA. I'm sorry. Then we will go back, we'll circle back to Model 1 afterwards. Under a Model 2 agreement, the Swiss government authorizes Swiss banks to report U.S. account information directly to the IRS without the threat of prosecution. So that eliminates the concern that Swiss banks originally had, the fear that by complying with FATCA, they were at the same time violating their own country's laws. So what this agreement does is it immunizes them and protects them from prosecution at the hands of their own government. And so it takes the pressure off and gives them some and gives them peace of mind, if you will, that there won't be a prosecution from their own government if they comply with FATCA. Thus, these institutions are guaranteed immunity from prosecution at the hands of the Swiss government. Prior to enactment of Model 2, Swiss banking laws were once extremely protective of client anonymity. We've already talked about that. Indeed, any bank or bank representative that revealed the details of a client's account to a foreign taxing authority could be charged with breaking Swiss bank secrecy laws, be prosecuted, and if convicted, sent to prison. Thus, a demand by the U.S. government or any government for the names and account holder information of U.S. account holders puts Swiss banks and bank personnel between a rock and a hard place. Once again, if they complied with the summons and exchanged such information, they would be breaking Swiss law and could be hauled into court and prosecuted by the Swiss government. On the other hand, if they thumbed their noses in the face of the US government, they could become the target of a US investigation more probing than a colonoscopy. Model 2 changed all of that. So the Foreign Financial Institution, or FFI, must provide the IRS with what's called nameless aggregates. I put that in quote because that's a term of art. No questions asked. Aggregate reporting refers to the aggregate number of non-consenting U.S. accounts, along with their total value, that are held by the foreign bank. Such information must be reported to the U.S. government without disclosing the identity of the respective clients, namely their names or their personal identifiers. Okay, so once again, the foreign financial institution under a Model 2 must provide the IRS with these nameless aggregates, and the aggregate reporting refers to the aggregate number of non-consenting U.S. accounts that the foreign bank holds. It's reported directly from the foreign financial institution to the U.S. government, and it's done without disclosing the identity of the clients. The foreign financial institution must identify all U.S. account holders whose account information is contained with the aggregate information reported. It must then notify the respective account holders and obtain their consent before disclosing their complete information. So this is an added second layer that must take place. So first, if you're keeping track of this, are the nameless aggregates that have to be turned over by the FFI to the U.S. government, no questions asked. The second layer of this consists of the foreign financial institutions then notifying the respective account holders whose information was disclosed via the aggregates, that the foreign bank must notify the account holders whose information was contained in those nameless aggregates and obtain their consent before disclosing their complete information to the IRS. And by complete information, I'm now referring to their taxpayer identification number, their name, their address, and their date of birth. So step one, the nameless aggregates are automatically, no questions asked, turned over from the foreign financial institution to the IRS. Step two, the foreign financial bank then notifies their account holders whose information has been turned over via these nameless aggregates, notify them that their information has been turned over to the government, and obtain their consent before disclosing their complete information to the IRS. So this notice that passed or that's sent from the FFI to the account holders who fall within the group of aggregate, of nameless aggregates, is called a declaration of consent. And what it does is it lists the parade of horribles that a U.S. account holder could expect to face if he or she does not consent to their complete information being turned over to the IRS. So it's kind of like giving them notice of their, telling them what is going to befall, all the bad things that are going to befall them if they don't comply and allow the bank to disclose their complete personal information to the IRS. So it's a veiled threat. That's really what it is. And some of these notices that I've read are downright scary, but nonetheless, it puts the taxpayer on notice and explains to the account holder what he or she can expect to happen if he does not consent to their to his personal information being turned over by the bank to the IRS. What happens next is nothing short of gamesmanship. Some U.S. account holders consent. Others will give their foreign bank the Italian salute and tell them where to go. These account holders who refuse to consent are referred to by the IRS in the not so flattering term as recalcitrant account holders. The foreign financial institution will provide the IRS with complete information on each of the account holders who consent. So in the wake of receiving one of a declaration of consent, if the taxpayer target decides to willingly consent and allow his or her personal information to be disclosed by the foreign bank to the IRS, then it's over. Nothing else then has to occur. However, those who withhold their consent form the second class of individuals. So the first class of individuals are those that willingly consent after they receive a declaration of consent, and then the foreign bank turns over their personal identifying information directly to the IRS. But what about this class of people who don't consent? Well, those who don't consent might just as well be fighting an uphill battle, because the IRS has the right to demand complete information on all recalcitrant account holders by making something called a group request. A group request is just that, a demand for complete information on all recalcitrant account holders. Upon receipt of a demand like this one, the foreign financial institution must provide complete information on all recalcitrant account holders to its respective government for exchange with the IRS. So you see what's happening here? We have a situation where the bank turns over a list of nameless aggregates. The IRS turns around, after the foreign bank turns over the nameless aggregates, it sends a declaration of consent to those individuals who were included in the nameless aggregates, asking them for their consent to turn over personal identifying information to the IRS. Two classes of people arise, one that automatically consent, and then the IRS turns their personal identifying information over to, the foreign bank turns their personal identifying information over to the IRS. The second class of people being those who withhold their consent. What happens next when it comes to those who withhold their consent? The IRS demands complete information on this class of people called recalcitrant account holders by making a group request. A group request is a demand for complete information on all recalcitrant account holders. Upon receipt of such a demand, the foreign financial institution must provide complete information on all recalcitrant account holders, not to the IRS, but to its respective government for exchange with the IRS. Note a subtle point. In dealing with recalcitrant account holders, the exchange of information is not made directly from the foreign financial institution to the IRS. Instead, the exchange is made from the foreign financial institution to its foreign government. The foreign government, in turn, has 6 months to provide the requested information to the U.S. government in the same format as it would have been reported if the foreign financial institution had reported it directly to the IRS. However, the taxpayer has the right to challenge the group request in Swiss court, albeit against unspeakable odds. Under a Model 1, now we transition to the Model 1 IGA, a foreign financial institution must report information directly to its respective government. The government, in turn, automatically exchanges this information with the tax authority in the relevant partner country once per year, pursuant to an income tax treaty or exchange of information agreement. So I'll say that once again. Under a Model 1, a foreign financial institution reports information directly to its respective government. The government, in turn, automatically exchanges this information with the tax authority in the relevant partner country once per year, pursuant to an income tax treaty or exchange of information agreement. When it comes to the U.S., the relevant tax authority is, of course, the IRS. Thus, Model 1 contemplates a direct and automatic exchange of information between taxing authorities. A simple way of viewing automatic exchange is as a box full of confidential documents that is covered in wrapping paper, adorned with a bow, and delivered to the doorstep of the IRS, complements, in this example, of the Swiss taxing authority. Major differences between Model 1 and Model 2. First, under Model 1, a foreign government serves as an intermediary to the supply of information from foreign financial institutions to the U.S. Under Model 2, foreign financial institutions report directly to the IRS, the nameless aggregates. The only time that a Model 2 implicates a foreign government is when the IRS makes a group information request for the names of recalcitrant account holders. So remember that there are two classes of individuals that arise in the aftermath of the foreign bank turning over nameless aggregates to the IRS. You have the group of individuals who do not consent, you have the group of individuals, who consent to their personal identifying information being turned over by the foreign financial bank directly to the IRS. And then you have those who form the second class of recalcitrant account holders who withhold their consent and do not allow their bank to turn their personal identifying information over to the IRS. In that case, the foreign bank has an obligation to turn the personal identifying information over to their government. And then the IRS can make a group request for that personal identifying information directly from the foreign government. So under Model 2, foreign financial institutions report directly to the IRS. The only time that a Model 2 implicates a foreign government is when the IRS makes a group information request. Then and only then must the foreign government provide specific U.S. account information directly to the IRS. This might shed light on why Model 1s are disfavored. They place a greater administrative burden on the foreign government. The second difference is a requirement under Model 2 that foreign financial institutions first obtain the consent of U.S. account holders before reporting their specific account information to the IRS. Indeed, nothing short of a U.S. account holder's unbridled consent is required before a foreign financial institution can turn that information over to the IRS. On the contrary, account holder consent is not required under Model 1 because account holder information is being exchanged automatically between the tax authorities of two countries. The takeaway: at the end of the day, a group request provides the IRS with the same information that the foreign financial institution would have reported to the IRS had it originally obtained the account holder's consent. The only difference is that it takes two steps: aggregate reporting and a group request instead of just one. In that sense, a Model 2 does indirectly what an automatic exchange under a Model 1 does directly. Change is on the horizon. The Swiss government will soon be transitioning to a Model 1 treaty. I believe they've already done so because some of this information is a little dated. But the Swiss government will soon be transitioning to a Model 1 treaty within the next few years, whereby the Swiss government will be exchanging information directly to the IRS and other countries' taxing authorities.
And our
that basically ends the presentation. I certainly encourage you, if you have any questions, to reach out for me. It was a pleasure presenting on this topic today. As you can tell, I'm deeply passionate about it, and it does get highly technical. So I did try to, bring some technical aspects of information sharing to you in order to help you when you have a client who might be the target of a summons, and you might need to know where to get started. And hopefully this presentation sheds some light on those steps that you can take in the early stages. All the time, however, I always encourage consulting with an attorney because these things are serious. And while initially it might look very innocent, sometimes the government has more information than you might imagine and is already beginning to create a roadmap to fraud. And so the sooner you can get an attorney involved, the sooner that attorney-client privilege can attach not only to the attorney's work product, but also to yours. So again, it's been an absolute pleasure presenting, and I wish you the very best. I'm going to log off now.
Hi, Michael. छोड़ के चला गया अब माइकल.